Hey guys, what you're about to listen to is the story of Japan's invasion of Manchuria. From the Hongutuan incident, all the way to the establishment of Manchukuo, and even the 1932 Battle of Shanghai for good measure. Now the reality is, the audio you're about to listen to actually was used to make 5 individual YouTube episodes over at the Pacific War Channel. So if you like your content in visual format, might I suggest checking them out? In the future, a long format documentary will also be created. Stating that, I would also like to acknowledge many of you audio listeners have recently joined my Patreon over at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel. Just want to say a big thanks to all of you who have joined the ranks over there. You guys are awesome. For those who don't know, over at my Patreon, for as little as $2 a month, you get access to my Patreon-exclusive podcasts, voting rights for what subjects I will tackle next, and other goodies based on other tiers. Please go check it out. But this episode is actually going to be the first official episode of the Pacific War podcast, 1931 to 1945. Buckle up. After the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 to 1905, Japan had developed the Kwangtung Army, a special security force established to protect the Kwangtung-Li's territory. This territory was along the South Manchurian Railway, extending from Mukden to Changchen. They had a lease for 99 years, but Japan being Japan, well, she sought more. Manchuria was always the great aim of the Japanese Empire. It was the breadbasket of Asia, a place of numerous untapped mineral resources and land for Japan's booming population to emigrate to. For the Japanese military, Manchuria was seen as a buffer state between Japan and her greatest enemy, the USSR. For Manchuria to fall under the control of the USSR, or even that of nationalist China, well, that was simply unacceptable. When the warlord era kicked off, Japan began supporting the Fengtian clique to harness influence over Manchuria. Now, the Fengtian clique was run by the Tiger of Manchuria, Zhang Zuolin. Japan extended their hand to Zhang Zuolin, offering military arms, advisors, and would even get involved now and then to suppress pesky uprisings, like that of General Guo Songling. In return, Zhang Zuolin kept the bandits at bay, allowed Japan to extensively invest in Manchuria, and protected her precious South Manchurian Railway. Times were good for the Tiger and his Japanese allies. Well, until they weren't. Even with Japan's backing, the warlord era seemed to be coming to an end with a nationalist victory in the form of Chiang Kai-shek's northern expedition. Chiang Kai-shek was closing in on Manchuria. He had just beat the Jade Marshal, Wu Pai-fu, Sun Quan-fang, alongside countless other warlords. Most of China proper now lay in his hands. To make matters even worse, good old Zhang Zuolin really only wanted to consolidate and expand his own territory, which, for the most part, he did. He held Manchuria. Thus, Zhang Zuolin began to cheat on Miss Japan by seeing other people, such as Britain and her rival, the United States. The Kwangtung Army tried to rein Zhang Zuolin back into the fold. When he was losing badly to Chiang Kai-shek in 1928, they tried to force him to retreat back into Manchuria, but he stubbornly stayed in Beijing fighting on. Zhang Zuolin continuously rejected Japanese demands, excluded his Japanese military advisors, and rejected requests to disarm and allow Japan further economic privileges in Manchuria. Zhang Zuolin was receiving a lot of heat from the rest of China, who were using propaganda campaigns labeling him as a Japanese stooge, which he really was. Thus, the old Tiger was trying to shake off the Japanese, and they became increasingly angry about that. Now, 1920s Japan was a time of much change, the kind of change one gets when they start watching too much Alex Jones. Japan was hit with the 1923 Great Kanto Earthquake, which was so damaging she almost moved her capital. 142,800 people died, 38,000 of which were incinerated by a firestorm after taking shelter at the Rikugun Honjo Hifukuso. 570,000 homes were destroyed, 1.9 million people were left homeless, and 1 billion, that's around 16 billion's worth today, of damages were incurred. This contributed to the Showa financial crisis, an economic bubble that burst shortly after World War I, leading to an economic depression. The situation was so bad, they even created earthquake bonds, which turned out to be a terrible decision when rumors sprang up that the bonds were worthless, causing people to panic sell. So yeah, Japan was going through a rough patch. Alongside her economic troubles, Japan's military was certainly undergoing some changes. One fateful man named Kanji Ishiwara was becoming a firebrand amongst his colleagues.
The best way to describe Kanji Ishiwata is, imagine making Alex Jones a senior officer in the United States military today, where he begins creating a cult of followers proclaiming an apocalyptic war was on the horizon. And the only way to prepare for it was to seize a large swath of land. Also, add a touch of Buddhism to that. Yes, that was the second Alex Jones joke that I just made. I'm done now, sorry. By the way, if you want to hear more about Kanji Ishiwata, please check out my Patreon for a full episode on how he got Japan to invade Manchuria. Long story short, Kanji Ishiwata had a theory about a final war, pitting Japan against America. He drew his conclusions on his understanding of military history and Nichiren Buddhism. In order to prepare for the final war, Japan needed to seize Manchuria. Kanji Ishiwata lectured at the Staff Army College and drew an enormous following, so much so, the Manchurian problem became an obsession amongst the military. Interesting note about Ishiwata, he was gravely concerned with not going to war with China. Yes, in retrospect, that is quite funny. He believed China's duty was to help modernize China, to ally with her, to face off against the West. Now, as you can imagine, the Kwangtung Army leadership became deeply interested in Ishiwata. He was speaking their kind of language. Now, in 1927, Tanaka Giichi became Prime Minister of Japan and began demanding railway and mining rights, to set up new factories and to rent out land from Jiang Zolin. This was met with large-scale protests. 100,000 people demonstrated in Shenyang, calling for Tanaka's cabinet to fall. Jiang Zolin rejected the demands and publicly said, "I, Jiang Zolin, am Chinese. I am at odds with the Japanese. Japan is trying to invade Northeast China. I, the king of the Northeast, will never allow it." Bold words, old marshal. Bold words. In June of 1927, an Eastern Regions Conference was formed by Premier Tanaka Giichi to formulate Japan's policy towards China and Manchuria. The conference came to no real conclusion on the matter, blurring any idea of what sort of action should be taken. The Kwangtung Army staff were greatly frustrated by their military leadership's inability to take action. A radical group within the Kwangtung Army emerged, headed by Colonel Komoto Daisaku, who believed they needed to eliminate Jiang Zolin because his usefulness had run its course and a new puppet was needed. Now in 1928, Chiang Kai-shek led an offensive against Beijing and Tianjin. Jiang Zolin's troops were fighting desperately to hold the region. Prime Minister Tanaka called in foreign representatives on May the 17th and explained Japan's strategy going forward. He wanted Jiang Zolin to withdraw from Beijing, and he would be permitted to enter Manchuria. But if he chose to continue fighting in Beijing, or make a fighting withdrawal back to Manchuria, Japan would prevent both Jiang Zolin and the Nationalists from entering Manchuria. Tanaka was under immense pressure from the radicals amongst the Kwangtung Army officers, calling for Japan to seize Manchuria. Tanaka, however, held firm, informing the Kwangtung Army Jiang Zolin would be allowed to remain in power and Japan would not forcefully occupy Manchuria. Well, Colonel Komoto had had enough with both Jiang Zolin and the Imperial Army leadership, and he took matters into his own hands. Jiang Zolin boarded a train on the evening of June the 3rd, 1928, going from Beijing to Shenyang via the Jingfeng Railway. The line was guarded by Fengxian troops, except for a bridge a few miles east of Hongguquan's train station. Colonel Sasaki Toichi alleged that after the Jinan incident, he gave Komoto the idea for assassinating Jiang Zolin via sabotage of a railway line. Komoto ordered a subordinate, Captain Kenyo Tomiya, to find a place where the train car bearing Jiang Zolin could be blown up. Kenyo found the bridge point and enlisted other Kwangtung officers, such as a major who was in charge of the guards in the area and a demolition expert who installed the explosives. Komoto also hired three dissatisfied Manchurians to be close by the explosion site. If Jiang Zolin survived the explosion, they were to rush over to his car and kill him. Saber First Lieutenant Sadatoshi Fuji planted the explosive charges along the track, which he exploded at 5:23 a.m. on June the 4th as Jiang Zolin's train passed over the bridge. Jiang Zolin was sitting at a mahjong table when his car blew up, sending a steel fragment into his nose which would kill him hours later. After the incident, Komoto's gang stabbed two out of the three Manchurians trying to pin the blame on them, but the third got away rushing straight to the headquarters of Jiang Zolin's son, Jiang Xuliang. Jiang Xuliang kept his father's death a secret for over 2 weeks while he secretly spoke with Chiang Kai-shek, striking a deal. Then Jiang Xuliang officially took his father's mantle as ruler of Manchuria on June the 21st. but knowing a public announcement of his father's assassins would cause a violent reaction from Japan, he chose to keep the peace. Oh, and by keeping the peace, he made sure to execute two of his father's pro-Japanese subordinates, who may have been implicated in the assassination. The Kwangtung Army leadership were caught completely off guard. They had been grooming one of Jiang Zolin's close confidants and great generals, Yang Yuqing. He was their greatest pro-Japanese Fangxian leader prospect to replace Jiang Zolin so they could retain control over Manchuria. However, Komodo's radical group had performed the assassination without proper approval of the Imperial General Headquarters nor from his own Kwangtung Army leadership. The Kwangtung Army was unable to rally forces together to take advantage of the chaos, because there simply was no chaos. Jiang Shuliang had made sure of that. Even with Jiang Shuliang as the new ruler, the Kwangtung Army still probably hoped that he would prove to be more pliant than his father, as he had a reputation as being a playboy and he was a rampant opium addict. But murdering his father proved to have backfired spectacularly, for he immediately switched allegiances from Japan to Chiang Kai-shek in December of 1928. He even got off the opium with the help of his friend, journalist William Donald. Way to go, Japan. Tanaka was outraged when he found out who was responsible and resolved to punish Komodo and his radical gang, but some of his fellow cabinet members sympathized with their cause and began to oppose holding the assassins responsible. Army Minister Shirakawa Yoshinori and Railway Minister Ogawa led a coalition against Tanaka, claiming his actions would harm the Imperial House, worsen Sino-Japanese relations, and undermine Japan's special interests in China. Oh, and of course, the cabinet did not want to be held accountable for basically allowing the radicals to do what they did. In the world of politics, we call this one, kids, throwing someone under the bus. Likewise, Emperor Hirohito was outraged, immediately calling for those responsible to be punished, which forced an internal investigation of the matter. Tanaka gave a formal report of what occurred to Emperor Hirohito, stating he intended to court-martial the assailants, purge the army, and re-establish discipline. Well, Tanaka would be informed later that the emperor refused to meet with him any further, leaving Tanaka alone to face the entire army, basically meaning he was being dismissed. Tanaka resigned, and the cabinet covered up the incident, treating it as an internal administrative matter. Emperor Hirohito accepted the army's intention to lie to the public about the incident and give the culprits minor administrative punishments. Thus, Hirohito saved his own face, but also allowed the Kwangtung Army to defy the Tokyo government, something that would not bite his ass later on. Colonel Komodo was forced to resign his post as senior staff officer, and he would be succeeded by Lieutenant Colonel Ishiwara. Komodo and Ishiwara would work very closely before he left his station, making sure the next steps to solve the Manchurian problem were met. After the failed attempt to seize control over Manchuria by assassinating Jiang Zolin during the Hongguzhen incident, Emperor Hirohito dismissed Prime Minister Tanaka Geichi for his inability to prosecute the low-ranking officers responsible. However, the next year, Hirohito privately condoned the army's cover-up of the incident, thereby encouraging further acts of military defiance. Ringleader Colonel Komoto Daisuku was forced to resign from his post as senior staff officer. He was replaced with Lieutenant Colonel Ishiwara Kanji, a man who became famous amongst many in the IGA for his lectures arguing the necessity for Japan to liberate China, so that a united East Asia could face the West in what he called the Final War. And hey, if you're interested in Ishiwara, over on my Patreon, I have a 4-part exclusive podcast series about his fascinating life and how he was behind major global events. Oh look, curtains! The new warlord over Manchuria, Jiang Shuliang, chose to ally with Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government. One of the first major events he found himself shoved into would be a squabble over the Chinese Eastern Railway with the new Soviet Union. The Soviet and Chinese governments held joint management over the railway line, but the Soviets always managed to grab majority control through some sleazy means. In 1929, the Chinese had had enough and they took over the railway line by force. The Soviets began retaliating in July, and this led to small skirmishes, which led to full-on battles. The Soviets invaded Chalai Nor, and then they sailed a small fleet up the Amur and Songhua rivers to invade Lhasa-Susu. The Soviets' advance was shockingly fast and effective, forcing the Chinese to sign the Khabarovsk Peace Protocol. The defeat of Jiang Shuliang's forces to the Red Army had not only reasserted Soviet dominance over the Chinese East Railway, It also showcased how weak the Chinese forces were, something the Kwangtung officers were observing. The Kwangtung army were shocked how well the Red Army performed. Their old rival was yet again threatening their control over Manchuria. The Japanese military leadership began to obsess over what they called the Manchurian problem. How could Japan consolidate and extend its influence over Manchuria? At this time, Japan held control over the South Manchurian Railway Company, allowing them to station Kwangtung Army forces around it and Japanese colonists within Manchuria. Now, the Kwangtung Army were greatly frustrated that Tokyo had not followed up on their assassination plot against Jiang Zolin, and instead ordered an investigation upon them. After the incident, Tokyo held multiple meetings to discuss what to do about the Manchurian problem, but the results kept being, let's wait another year, frustrating the radical officers in the Kwangtung Army. Many in the Kwangtung Army believed military occupation of Manchuria was the only means to overcome the threat of Soviet or Chinese nationalist influence. The seizure of Manchuria had been one of Japan's major aims since she had come out of isolation in the later half of the 19th century. Manchuria held natural resources, growing space for her booming population, and was an ideal buffer state between her and the Soviet Union. For Ishiwara, Manchuria represented an economic and industrial base for Japan to prepare for his theorized final war against America. Ishiwara and his like-minded colleague, Colonel Seishiro Itagaki, began devising a plan on how to seize Manchuria. In June of 1929, they began a program of sending Kwangtung Army officers into northern Manchuria under the guise it was to perform reconnaissance operations against the Soviet Union, but in reality, it was to prepare a full-scale invasion of Manchuria. Kwangtung officers were sent to observe and note Jiang Shuliang's garrisons, the terrain, and how long it would take to mobilize any given units in any given places. By the summer of 1930, Ishiwara had formed a plan based on the famous Japanese night attack during the Russo-Japanese War. The Kwangtung Army needed to overcome their considerable inferiority in size and equipment. Around Mukden alone, Jiang Shuliang had 20,000 men, equipped with tanks and aircraft. Throughout the rest of Manchuria, Jiang Shuliang could rally another 250,000, while the Kwangtung Army could only muster around 10,000 men, consisting of a single integrated division and six battalions guarding the railway. They had no aircraft, nor proper mechanized forces, and their artillery was not all that impressive. Ishiwara's answer to this was to combine skillful use of intelligence gathered on the enemy and intense training to perfect assault techniques necessary so that when the time came, they could produce surprise, speed, and effective concentration of force. Ishiwara would wager everything on dealing a crushing blow at the center of Jiang Shuliang's military strength, the Peitaing Barracks at Mukden. Its fall would reduce the enemy's morale, giving the Kwangtung Army the psychological momentum it would need to subdue the Chinese forces in the surrounding areas. Yet even with all of this, it would not be enough. Thus, Ishiwara also met with Lieutenant Colonel Kanda Masatane of the Korea Army for assurances they would join in if the time came. But how would they justify an invasion? Ishiwara and Itagaki chose to perform a false flag operation. They would sabotage a railway section near Liaoqiao Lake, just 800 meters away from their first objective, the Peitaing Barracks. They would simply blow up some tracks and then blame it on the local Chinese troops. Ishiwara spent 1929 to 1931 lecturing the army and attending meetings with the general staff, arguing the Manchurian problem needed to be dealt with via force. However, Tokyo argued the time was not ripe for such things and that national reconstruction must first be undertaken. The Army HQ in Tokyo agreed Manchuria was vital to the defense against the USSR, but they only sought to control southern Manchuria via the railway and had no ambitions to take the north. In June of 1931, Ishiwara argued the seizure of Manchuria had to occur immediately because the Soviet Union's five-year plan was in mid-course. The United States, Britain, and France had yet to overcome their financial crisis. The League of Nations was obviously powerless. And lastly, the Chinese nationalists had yet to fully unify their efforts north of the Great Wall. But the top brass told him they would need to postpone such ideas until at least another year while they negotiated with the Chinese and tried to rally foreign support for their case in Manchuria. Ishiwara and Itagaki were outraged by the army leadership's foot-dragging on the issue. They returned to Manchuria in July of 1931, and they found out one of their secret reconnaissance groups in northern Manchuria had a man missing. One Captain Nakamura Shintaro. rumors emerged that he had been murdered by Chinese soldiers. On top of this, the past several months saw a dramatic increase in riots, killings, and strikes against Japanese civilians within Manchuria. The Nakamura incident simply added another issue to many others, and now Ishiwara wanted to exploit it as a suitable pretext for an invasion. Ishiwara issued orders to dispatch an armored train with a mixed regiment of infantry and artillery to force the Chinese military authorities at Mukden to lend assistance in the investigation of Nakamura's disappearance. However, Central HQ blocked the train's departure at the very last minute, and a telegram from Tokyo came in specifically ordering the Kwangtung Army not to use the Nakamura incident as a means to force the solution to the Manchurian problem. This was the last straw for Ishiwara. He and his followers would go through with their plan without permission from high command. Alongside the Nakamura situation, another one was boiling. Colonel Doriara Kenji was involved in a scheme to use the warlord Yan Qishan to attack Jiang Shuliang. This was drawing unwanted attention and lessening the effectiveness of the Nakamura incident. Thus, Ishiwara quickly quelled the plots. Rumors began circulating in Tokyo that the Kwangtung Army was about to retaliate against the Chinese because of the Nakamura situation. This prompted War Minister General Minami to send Major General Yoshichi Tachikawa to Mukden to warn the Kwangtung Army officers to stop any plans to do so. Ishiwara was alerted of his arrival, and he sent panicked telegrams to his followers stating this: "Plot exposed. Act before Tachikawa's arrival." Thus, the launch date of September the 28th was pushed for the 18th. Itagaki personally intercepted Tachikawa's train and invited him for tea, sake, and sent him to bed with a geisha on the night of the 18th. On September the 18th of 1931, 1st Lieutenant Sumori Kawamoto of the Independent Garrison Unit of the 29th Infantry Regiment planted bombs along the tracks near Liaotaoko. At 10:20 p.m., they exploded, doing only minor damage to 1.5 meters of track on the site. The damage was so minor, a train actually passed over the tracks without difficulty just 10 minutes later. Ishiwara, Itagaki, and their followers quickly announced the explosion to be a Chinese atrocity and mobilized the Kwangtung Army. Itagaki ordered the Independent Garrison Force and 29th Infantry Regiment to storm the Peitiang Barracks. Battalion Commander Shimamoto was awakened by orders via telephone, and he quickly dispatched the 1st Ono and 4th Takahashi Companies from Mukden, the 2nd Kawakami Company at Fushen, to advance to Liaotaoko. At 10:40 p.m., the 29th Regiment Commander Hirata got a call from Shimamoto, who ordered him to get his regiment into emergency formation and to storm the Peitiang Barracks. Two secretly hidden artillery pieces began to bombard the Peitiang Barracks as 500 Japanese stormed the 7,000-strong Chinese garrison. Despite being outnumbered 14-1, the Japanese destroyed Jiang Shuliang's small air force, routed the Chinese, and occupied the Peitiang Barracks by 11 p.m., all at the cost of 500 Chinese lives and allegedly only two Japanese. A major reason the Japanese had an easy way of it was because Jiang Shuliang ordered his men to store away their weapons and to not put up a fight against the Japanese if they invaded. Jiang Shuliang and Chiang Kai-shek were both in Beijing at this time, and they knew they could not initiate an offensive war against such a strong foreign country. They were instead hoping the League of Nations would intervene as pertaining to the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928. But later on, Chiang Kai-shek would find America too wrapped up in its depression back home, Britain indifferent, and other nations without enough reason to risk anything in the Far East. An hour after the attack, Ishiwara began urging the recently arrived commander-in-chief for the Kwangtung Army, General Shigeru Hanjo, to order reinforcements to help seize all of Mukden. Hanjo's first reaction was to hesitate, but Ishiwara assured him there was significant enemy provocation. Thus, he ordered additional units to enter the combat and seize all of Mukden. Historians ever since have had a hard time figuring out exactly what Hanjo knew of the invasion plot, and it seems likely he knew some of it, but not the entire plan, leading him to be very cautious in his actions for the next few weeks. The next few days would see Hanjo trying to order the forces to localize the incident. But Ishiwara and Itagaki relentlessly pushed all forces to stick to the secret plan they had all trained for. The speed and decisiveness was not only too much for the Chinese, it left Hanjo powerless to alter its course. Famously, when one colleague asked Itagaki what to do in response to the cease and desist orders coming from Hanjo, Itagaki responded,
Never mind, Hanjo. It's Ishiwata's war.
Official orders from Tokyo came about the next day, specifically opposing the expansion of hostilities, but Ishiwani Tegaki had come too far to stop now. They began persuading Hanjo to telegram the general's staff to ask for reinforcements and freedom of action.
To pursue actively the security and order of all Manchuria.
But secretly, they also dispatched military agents to Kirin to foment civil disturbances in the city to make it seem like 900 Japanese residents' lives and property were endangered. When reports came to Hanjo of this, Ishiwata urged him to deploy the main Kwangtung Army force to Kirin to protect them and ask the Korea Army for assistance. Hanjo hesitated again, prompting Ishiwata to threaten his resignation on the 20th, pushing his radical followers to do the very same. Under immense pressure, Hanjo caved into their demands. Despite all of the pressure placed on Hanjo, I would note, most historians agree Hanjo was on board with most of this and was simply making things look like he was being pressured to do so in case things went badly. The attack on Kirin was carried out with incredible speed. Ishiwata ordered the 2nd Division of General Daimonjiro to assault the city by rail, leaving Mukden virtually unguarded. Daimon entered Kirin without firing a single shot, and he forced the local Chinese military commander to proclaim the independence of the province from Zhang Shuliang. Hours later, the Korea Army responded to the request for help, and on the 21st, they were advancing into Manchuria. The invasion had begun.
On September the 18th of 1931, the Japanese performed a false flag operation, detonating explosives over the South Manchurian Railway near Mukden, before 500 Kwangtung soldiers stormed the Peiteng barracks, defended by 7,000 men of Zhang Shuliang's forces. Zhang Shuliang was in Beiping on September the 18th in his capacity as North China Garrison Commander. Those around him, including Chiang Kai-shek, advised him to order his men not to resist, to hide away all weapons and try to retreat westwards if possible. Chiang Kai-shek knew the Japanese were trying to provoke a full-on war with China, one they could not possibly hope to win at this time. China required more time to gather and train her forces to face such an enemy. For his part, Zhang Shuliang was well aware of how weak his forces were, and he sought to retain a sizable army. Thus, the orders were in his best interest. Both men also believed the League of Nations or perhaps the Wakatsuki cabinet would step in to restrain the unlawful occupation. During the battle at the Beiteng barracks, 500 Chinese soldiers were killed. Countless surrendered, others fled as the Japanese destroyed the barracks and a small air force there. Meanwhile, Ishiwata pressured a hesitant General Shigeru Hanjo to request reinforcements and freedom of action from Tokyo HQ. Tokyo HQ reiterated orders to not expand the hostilities, but Ishiwata and his colleague Itagaki had worked too hard to stop now. Ishiwata's plan was to overwhelm all potential centers of enemy resistance and occupy all of Manchuria with or without the support of high command. Seeking to expand the hostilities through official channels, Ishiwata fomented civil disturbances in major cities while stating to Tokyo HQ, the Kwangtung Army, had to protect Japanese residents in said areas. The first place hit was Kirin. Ishiwata and his fellow officers threatened to resign if Hanjo did not order an attack against Kirin, and Hanjo buckled. The 2nd Division of General Tamanjiro advanced by rail and captured nearly every city en route to Kirin, where his force entered without firing a shot, forcing the local Chinese military commander to proclaim the independence of the province from Zhang Shuliang. Hours later, on September the 21st, the commander, Hayashi Senjiro, on his own initiative, ordered the Korea Army to cross the border to reinforce Manchuria. The weeks after the Mukden incident saw widespread cooperation between the Japanese invaders and local Chinese leaders. Some areas saw valiant fighting, but it was not coordinated well and held little overall effect. The Kwangtung Army, meanwhile, had relatively few troops in an area over 350,000 square miles large, with a population of 30 million, and thus could not hope to conquer it through sheer force alone. Thus, Ishiwata planned to form alliances with local strongmen, and this was encouraged heavily by the Nanjing government, who ordered Zhang Shuliang to not resist and to await negotiations. Bolstered by their success at Kirin, Mukden was taken in just a day's time. The Japanese reported,
"The people stood in the streets as if they were watching a festival."
At Mukden, the Eastern Borders Garrison Commander, Yu Jishan, immediately allied with the Japanese. The governor of Liaoning, Zhang Jiyi, refused to cooperate in establishing a collaborationist government, so the Japanese imprisoned him and installed Colonel
Doihara Kenji as mayor of Bukden, who ruled the city with an emergency committee composed mostly of Japanese. Until October the 20th, when the post was handed over to Zhao Jinbo, a legal advisor to the Kwangtung Army. Jiangchun took a bit longer. On September the 23rd, the Japanese ordered the forces in Jilin to surrender. Their acting commander, Xi Xia, agreed, though some of his soldiers fought, leading to the deaths of 200 Chinese soldiers and 10 civilians. On September the 24th, Xi Xia dissolved the old government and proclaimed independence with himself as governor. Jiang Jinghui declared the Harbin Special Zone autonomous, Ji Xing surrendered the Yanbian Korean Autonomous Prefecture area, and the former governor of Liaoning Province, Zhang Jiyi, was released from prison and immediately declared the new autonomous province of Fengtian. By the end of September, the Japanese occupied major cities such as Liaoyang, Yingkou, Fuxian, Mukden, Xiping, Dangdong, Changchun, Jian, Jiaohe, and Dunhua. Zhang Shiliang's forces surrendered, fled, and many actively cooperated by creating independence movements. Roughly 60,000 men of Zhang Shiliang's forces would surrender and be recruited en masse into the Japanese cooperative forces, alongside Hong Huzi and civilians. Meanwhile, because the governor, Wan Fulin, of Heilongjiang province was in Beiping, leaving no one with authority to deal with the Japanese, Zhang Shiliang appointed General Ma Jiaxan as acting chairman and military commander-in-chief of Heilongjiang province on October the 16th. General Ma Jiaxan arrived at the capital, Qiqihar, on the 19th and began personally inspecting the troops and defensive positions. Multiple parties sought to surrender and join the Japanese, but Ma Jiaxan declared, "I am appointed as chairman of the province, and I have the responsibility to defend the province, and I will never be a surrendering general." General Ma Jiaxan chose to disobey the Kuomintang's orders not to resist the Japanese. General Zhang Haipeng of the 2nd Provincial Defense Brigade at Tainan had taken command of the local forces, including the Xing'an Reclamation Army, to declare the district independent from China. This was done in return for a large shipment of weapons from Japan, and Zhang Haipeng's first political move would be to attack Ma Jiaxan. Lieutenant General Tan Monjiro requested Zhang Haipeng capture Heilongjiang, thereupon later to invite the Japanese to assist them in governance. On October the 13th, Zhang Haipeng ordered 3 regiments of the new Huseng'an Reclamation Army under General Xu Jinglong to capture Qiqihar, the capital of Heilongjiang. Some elements of Qiqihar surrendered peacefully. However, Xu Jinglong's advance guard with an engineering company was attacked by forces led by General Du Liangfang defending the north bank. Zhang Haipeng's men were forced to flee, suffering heavy casualties. During the battle, Ma Jiaxan had his forces use dynamite to damage the Nanjiang Railroad Bridge. The Japanese began to repeatedly demand Ma Jiaxan allow them to repair the bridge, but he continuously refused, and he had his forces defend the area near Daxing, preventing Zhang Haipeng's men from proceeding north. A stalemate soon emerged where the two forces would fight in the Daxing area. On November the 3rd, Ma Jiaxan reached a compromise with the Japanese to end hostilities and allow the bridge to be repaired. On November the 4th, Ma Jiaxan sent subordinates to accompany Major Hayashi Yoshihide, "so that the Japanese might begin work, and so that I could order my army to start to retreat." Ma Jiaxan gave assurances the Japanese repairing the operation would not be interfered with, meanwhile telegramming his subordinates, "Paint all of Manchuria red with the blood of Japanese troops." A force of 800 Japanese led by Major General Shogo Hasebe with his repair crews came to the area to find Daxing a war zone. Shogo found Ma Jiaxan's subordinate on the ground, Xu Baojun, and demanded the fighting cease so they could repair the bridge. Xu Baojun said he never received any orders to cease fighting. The Japanese claimed the nearby 2,500 Chinese troops of Ma Jiaxan began opening fire upon them using rifles and machine guns. The Japanese returned fire likewise, and Japanese aircraft began strafing the Chinese, forcing them to retreat towards Qiqihar. The Chinese would suffer 120 casualties, the Japanese 15. The Japanese then sent word to Ma Jiaxan, demanding he make true on his promise. But Ma Jiaxan responded that of his 15,000 troops, he could only nominally control about a third. Ma Jiaxan then sent a telegram to the League of Nations reading this,
"I am helpless. I have exhausted all attempts to preserve peace. I have strictly instructed my commanders to act only on the defensive, and that they must not attack. But Major Hayashi has seen this behavior by the Japanese military, and not only has not stopped it, but, on the contrary, wants our army to withdraw from Heilongjiang province, so that they can carve up the whole lot. Since the 4th, the Japanese army has started to attack our army. They are coordinating land and air attacks, carrying out utterly horrible bombings. The battle area widened to Qixihai, and by November the 5th, Ma Jiaxian had 400 killed and 300 wounded, but he refused to surrender. On November the 15th, General Hanzhe Shigeru sent a list of demands that Ma Jiaxian's troops withdraw north of Qixihai, Heilongjiang must declare independence, and Ma Jiaxian must resign. Ma Jiaxian refused the demands and launched a counterattack, trying to dislodge the Japanese from the bridge area. But now the Japanese were being supported by tanks and heavy artillery. By 2 p.m. on November the 16th, the Japanese began an offensive that would soon overwhelm his forces. 3,500 Japanese troops of the 2nd Division, led by General Taemonjiro, attacked 8,000 defenders at Qixihai along a 5-mile front around the heights of Sanqianfeng, south of Tangqi. Japanese cavalry charged the Chinese front line, followed up by infantry. Ma Jiaxian's right flank held them back as his cavalry tried to encircle the Japanese right flank, but the Japanese tanks, artillery, and aerial support repelled them. The Japanese superior firepower would win the day, as Ma Jiaxian stated, "The Japanese had 4 cavalry units who ran amok everywhere, and they used 2 aeroplanes to bomb Qixihai into submission through terror. The merchants were utterly terrified, making pleas that the areas where they were should be avoided, so as to prevent misery amongst the people." The civilian population pushed Ma Jiaxian to pull out, a long-held Chinese tradition that did not mean to lose face, but rather living to fight another day. On November the 18th, Ma Jiaxian's forces evacuated Qixihai, and by the 19th, he led them east to defend Baiquan and Haiduan. His army suffered tremendous casualties, possibly up to 3,000, with the Japanese claiming 300 casualties for themselves. Ma Jiaxian's forces then retired to the Nonyi River Valley and eventually over the Soviet border. The Japanese began an occupation of Qixihai, thus securing control over all 3 Manchurian provincial capitals. They quickly established a collaborationist government under General Jiang Jinghui and secured control over the central section of the Chinese Eastern Railway. However, the eastern section of the railway was still under the control of General Qing Chao, operating out of Harbin. Qing Chao would follow up Ma Jiaxian's example, inspiring local Chinese to aid and enlist in the resistance effort. Ma Jiaxian drew international attention through a series of telegrams he sent describing his campaign of resistance against the Japanese in Heilongjiang. His stand along the Nonyi River near Qixihai lionized him amongst the Chinese nationalists who sought to use his public image to shame Chiang Kai-shek into action against the Japanese. The unofficial war between China and Japan had only just begun. After the Mukden incident, Japan began forcefully occupying major cities throughout Manchuria and forming alliances with local Chinese leaders to consolidate control. Chiang Kai-shek knew the Japanese were trying to provoke a full-scale war, but China needed more time to gather and train her forces to face such an enemy. Thus, in the meantime, Chiang Kai-shek ordered Jiang Shuliang to order his forces not to resist and to await negotiations. The Kwangtung army had explicit orders never to advance past the South Manchurian Railway, frustrating the efforts of Lieutenant Colonel Ishiwara Kanji, the mastermind behind the invasion of Manchuria. After consolidating the area around the South Manchurian Railway, Ishiwara turned his attention towards Jinzhou. Jinzhou became Jiang Shuliang's administrative HQ and civil government after the fall of Mukden. Thus, it was there that all the Chinese forces were concentrating. According to Japanese sources, Jiang Shuliang began secretly ordering local governments in Manchuria to obey and pay taxes in Jinzhou. He sent spies to Japanese-occupied areas and was plotting the assassination of Japanese and anti-Chiang Kai-shek officials. On October the 8th, Ishiwara led 5 captured Chinese aircraft, part of the 10th Independent Air Squadron from Mukden to raid Jinzhou, stating he was merely performing a reconnaissance. They flew over Jinzhou around 1:40 p.m. and dropped 75 25-kilogram bombs, hitting the 28th Division's barracks, government buildings, and Jiang Shuliang's residence. They also took photos of the Chinese defensive positions. The attack had 2 purposes: to threaten Jiang Shuliang and Tokyo HQ.
The bombing of Jinchō created a fervor in Tokyo, as well as shocking the League of Nations, who at this point were still ambivalent to the situation. Tokyo HQ was obliged to issue post-facto approval of the Kwangtung actions, but they were repeatedly demanding a cease of any more. Rumors emerged Ishiwara and his colleague Itagaki sought to create an independent Manchuria and to use it as a base for a coup d'etat against the Japanese government to usher in a Showa restoration. On October the 18th, War Minister Minamijiro ordered the Kwangtung Army by telegram to cease offensive actions in Manchuria, and he sent Colonel Imamura Hitoshi to make Ishiwara and Itagaki stop their reckless operation. However, when Hitoshi met the two men at a restaurant in Mukden, they simply brushed him off. In truth, Ishiwara and Itagaki's plans were endangered, but then in early November they were given a pretext after the forces of Ma Jie-shan damaged the railway bridge at Nanjiang. Ma Jie-shan's hostility gave them a pretext to invade Heilongjiang with their allies led by General Jiang Haipeng. For more information, check out my episode on The Invasion of Manchuria, the Jiang Chao Campaign. Tokyo was forced to endorse the action, calling it a defensive operation. After the occupation of the north, another opportunity presented itself in the southwest. The first Tianjin incident broke out on November the 9th, instigated by Colonel Tohara Kenji with the help of some anti-Chiang Kai-shek Chinese. A small force attached to the Peace Preservation Corps at Tianjin, led by Tohara, performed the scheme, hoping to use the resulting confusion to abduct the former Manchu emperor, Puyi, so that the Kwangtung army could later place him on the throne of a new Manchurian state. Tohara requested reinforcements from Tokyo HQ, but they denied the request, so he went to the Kwangtung army for help. The Kwangtung army stated they would coordinate an attack upon Tianjin to help, but only if a pretext was provided. To pull off such a maneuver would require first seizing Jinzhou. Then a second Tianjin incident occurred on November the 26th. The Japanese barracks in Tianjin were attacked by Chinese soldiers at 8:20 p.m., but this was another false flag operation orchestrated by Tohara. Upon receiving the news, General Honjo Shigeru decided to assist the Tianjin army, whom they deemed were in danger. The 4th Mixed Brigade and 2nd Infantry Battalion of the 2nd Division, 10,000 men strong, advanced upon 13 armored trains along the Baiping-Mukden Railway. The Kwangtung Army also asked for help from the Korea Army, and Commander Hayashi prepared a mixed brigade to cross the border. The force got within 30 kilometers of Jinzhou when War Minister Jiro ordered them to immediately withdraw. The Kwangtung Army continued, however, and got into some skirmishes with Chinese defenders around the Dailing River and Takushan. Tokyo HQ began sending countless furious messages demanding the Kwangtung Army withdraw from the Jinzhou area, and by the 28th, they finally did. Prime Minister Wakatsuki Reizuo began negotiating with the Republic of China through the League of Nations, who proposed a neutral zone should be established between China proper and Manchuria. The Chinese, British, American, and French were offering to withdraw their troops from Jinzhou to Shanaiguan if the Manchurian incident was settled and Japan would pledge not to violate the area. Thus, Tokyo HQ favored this policy and ordered the Kwangtung Army to pull out. Jiang Shuliang had promised to pull his men out from Jinzhou by December the 7th, but this never occurred. The Japanese then began negotiating to make Jinzhou a neutral zone. The Kwangtung Army intercepted two Chinese telegrams indicating Jiang Shuliang was strengthening the defenses at Jinzhou, and that Nanjing was requesting he not pull his men out. The telegrams were sent to Tokyo HQ, who agreed the Chinese were acting in a treacherous manner. The Japanese ambassador then told U.S. Secretary Henry Stimson,
"It would be very difficult to withhold the army from advancing again."
Stimson replied,
"Such actions would convince the American public that Japan's excuse for her incursions, namely that she was combating bandit attacks, was a ruse to destroy the last fragment of Chinese authority in Manchuria. It would be extremely difficult to ask China to withdraw her army from her own territory."
And thus began the Jinzhou crisis. Nationalist Minister of Finance T.V. Sung sent a telegram to Jiang Shuliang advising,
"Any Japanese attack on Jinzhou should be offered utmost resistance."
And the American minister in China publicly expressed the view that Jiang Shuliang would resist at Jinzhou if attacked.
Yet to all observers, it was evident Japan was intent on taking Jinzhou, and was just waiting for any pretext to do so. The Japanese even began bombing disused sections of trail track on December the 10th, disrupting traffic on the Beiping-Mukden rail line, hinting at their intentions. On December the 13th, Prime Minister Wakatsuki resigned, having failed to control the military. A new cabinet led by Prime Minister Toyoshi Unukai resumed negotiations with Nanjing, but on December the 15th, Chiang Kai-shek resigned as chairman of the Nanjing government, leaving Sun Kei to lead a weak interim government. Preoccupied with its own survival, the Nanjing government had no time to deal with the Jinzhou crisis. On December the 15th, Tokyo HQ telegraphed Mukden instructing the Kwangtung Army to synchronize an assault on Jinzhou with an attack upon bandits. Tokyo HQ even agreed to send reinforcements from Korea and Japan. The 20th Division, the 38th Mixed Brigade of the 19th Division both crossed the border from Korea, and the 8th Mixed Brigade, 10th Division came over from Japan. With this, the Kwangtung Army had been bolstered to around 60,450 men. On December the 17th, the Japanese began attacking what they called soldier bandits in Fakyu and Changtusin. In reality, it was a prelude to an assault against Jinzhou. Then on December the 18th, Japanese aircraft bombed Dangliu, killing three Chinese and throwing the city into a panic. By December the 26th, all preparations for an assault against Jinzhou were complete. On December the 28th, Honzhou ordered an anti-bandit drive west of the Liao River. Honzhou insisted publicly they were just clearing the country of bandits, but also added if the Chinese forces at Jinzhou were to withdraw, they would not be molested. While the Japanese and their collaborationist allies spread out along the South Manchurian Railway, clearing out pockets of resistance, from Mukden, the 12th Division led by Lieutenant General Jiro Tamon advanced towards Jinzhou supported by squadrons of bombers. Japanese intelligence estimated Zhang Shuliang had 84,000 defenders, 58 pieces of artillery, with two separate lines of defense for the city. The first line of defense ran 20 miles north of the city. It was a series of trenches aimed to halt the Japanese advance at the Daling River Bridge on the Beiping-Mukden Railway. The second line of defenses were earthworks and entrenchments completely encircling Jinzhou. The weather was negative 30 degrees, and the IJA forces wore winter camouflage uniforms. IJA reconnaissance aircraft reported a force of around 3,000 Hanghuzi were waiting to ambush them around Panshan County. Tamon's forces brushed aside the Hanghuzi in a series of small skirmishes and continued their advance to Gobangzi, 50 kilometers north of Jinzhou. By December the 31st, the Japanese vanguard reached 15 kilometers from Jinzhou on the banks of the Daling River. Tamon halted, waited for the rest of the 2nd Division to catch up. Then Tamon's men began erecting an elaborate system of microphones to broadcast the sounds of the upcoming battle to Tokyo. It seems this might have been a ploy to demoralize the defenders, and it certainly worked as Zhang Shuliang's men began to withdraw. It turned out on December the 30th, Zhang Shuliang had given the orders to withdraw from Jinzhou. The last Chinese troop train departed Jinzhou at 11 a.m. on the morning of January the 1st of 1932. With that, the last vestiges of Zhang Shuliang's power in Manchuria had left. The assault upon Jinzhou came at the worst possible time for China. Chiang Kai-shek was momentarily out of office. He did not have the full backing of the Nanjing government, nor that of many of his generals. It is also likely Chiang Kai-shek knew Zhang Shuliang's forces at Jinzhou would have been greatly outmatched and potentially annihilated. What was important was to keep the situation from becoming an official war, so he could build up China's forces to fight back. With the fall of Jinzhou, the Northern China Army retreated south of the Great Wall, into Hubei Province. The Japanese then occupied Shanaguan, thus southern Manchuria was now fully under their control. Chiang Kai-shek knew the Japanese were trying to provoke a full-scale war, but China needed more time to gather and train her forces to face such an enemy. While most generals complied with Chiang Kai-shek's orders to not resist, General Ma Jiaxuan did not. Ma Jiaxuan resisted the Japanese during the Jiang Chao campaign. Please check out my episode on it for more information. Though Ma Jiaxuan and his men were driven out from Qichihar, he quickly set up new headquarters in Hailuan. Ma Jiaxuan had become a world-famous resistance hero since his doomed battle at Qichihar. The Kwangtung Army took notice of this and they changed their tactics.
Komai Tokutsu, the head of the Kwangtung Board of Control, advocated that they should bring Ma Jaishan into the fold, as it would be an enormous propaganda boost. The Japanese sent a local factory owner, Han Yunjie, to persuade Ma Jaishan to negotiate with the Kwangtung Army. On December the 7th, Colonel Itagaki Seishiro held a meeting with Ma Jaishan at Hailun. Itagaki stated the Japanese sought two things, peace in East Asia and the complete cooperation between the Chinese and Japanese. Itagaki also went on to say the Kwangtung Army officers were very impressed by Ma Jaishan's brilliant display of bravery and would give him military command over Heilongjiang as long as they came to an understanding. Ma Jaishan responded that his troops had acted only in self-defense and that he was subject to the orders of the Nanjing government. Itagaki then suggested Ma Jaishan might be appointed military commander of the province under the provincial governor in Qichihar, Jiang Jinghui. To this, Ma Jaishan replied,
"As Hailuan is not very far from Harbin, you could consult with General Jiang Jinghui over the telephone or pay a call on the latter in person, and that a second trip to Hailuan by the Japanese representative would not be necessary."
Despite Ma Jaishan's stance, Itagaki was pleased with the meeting. He felt Ma Jaishan might join them, but he was hamstrung by anti-Japanese colleagues such as his chief of staff, Xie Ke, and battalion commander Tang Fengjia. When Zhang Shuliang withdrew his forces from Qinzhou, this greatly changed things for Ma Jaishan. On December the 7th, Itagaki and Ma Jaishan met again, but this time Ma Jaishan indicated he would prefer to be both the military and governor of Heilongjiang. However, unbeknownst to the Japanese, Ma Jaishan was secretly talking to another resistance leader, General Ding Chao. When Ma Jaishan began his resistance against the Japanese, Ding Chao resolved to do the very same in the northern metropolis of Harbin. Harbin had not seen as much violence when the Japanese were able to control it by appointing a puppet general, Xi Qia, as the head of the government for Qianlin province. Ding Chao, alongside Ling Du, Xing Jiangqing, Zhao Yi, and Feng Jianghai, organized the Qianlin self-defense army to prevent the takeover of Harbin and Qianlin province. Ma Jaishan supported Ding Chao, and both generals kept in contact with Zhang Shuliang and Chiang Kai-shek, who would provide limited assistance. In early January of 1932, the Japanese ordered General Xi Qia to seize Harbin using his new Qianlin army, then to advance upon Ma Jaishan's HQ at Hailun. On January the 24th, representatives from Li Du and Ding Chao attended a conference with Ma Jaishan's officers and persuaded them to launch an attempt to recapture Qichihar and to hold Harbin for resistance. The next day, the new Qianlin army advanced to Xiangcheng, alerting the Chinese resistance fighters that an assault was imminent. Zhang Shuliang ordered generals Ma Jaishan and Ding Chao to discontinue negotiations and to make a stand. By late January, the Qianlin Self-Defense Corps were 30,000 strong, consisting of 6 brigades. General Ding Chao dug into defensive positions between General Xi Qia's advancing force and Harbin. Xi Qia had not suspected the resistance forces would be so well organized, and his army suffered heavily. They were unable to break through. Xi Qia began pleading for help from the Kwangtung army, but they required a pretext to intervene. Yet again, Colonel Doihara Kenji created another false flag operation. Doihara engineered a riot in Harbin, leading to the deaths of 1 Japanese and 3 Koreans. Under the pretext that Japanese subjects were threatened, the 2nd Division of Lieutenant General Jiro Taman began advancing to Harbin from Jinzhou on January the 28th. However, the winter weather was quite severe, delaying their transportation. To make matters even worse, the Soviets refused to allow the Japanese trains to advance to Harbin using their part of the Chinese Eastern Railway on the grounds it would breach neutrality. The entire Manchurian incident had created a tense situation between the USSR and Japan. When they invaded Heilongjiang, there was a real fear the Soviets might intervene, and it seemed that they might also be at Harbin. But at the last moment, the Soviets agreed to allow the transit on January the 30th. In the meantime, General Ding Chao arrested the governor of Heilongjiang province, General Zhang Jinghui, and seized the municipal administration in Harbin. General Ding Chao then redeployed his forces, trying to embroil the Soviet Union into the mix by positioning his artillery right in front of the Soviet offices for the Chinese Eastern Railroad. While Ding Chao's forces were able to keep Xi Qia's men at bay, against the Japanese they would be outgunned, outnumbered, and untrained. Many of Ding Chao's forces were civilian volunteers from the Harbin area.
the 2nd Japanese Division began their attack on February the 4th, unleashing an artillery and aerial bombardment against the west and southern defensive lines of Harbin. Ting Chao's barracks were destroyed. His entrenchments could not be held under such intense fire. Ding Chao's army was forced to withdraw northeast, heading down to the Sangari River, pursued by Japanese aircraft that strafed them along the way. Ding Chao's army had fought a 17-hour battle, but ultimately lost. With the defeat of General Ding Chao, Ma Jieshan finally decided to defect. On February the 16th, General Honjo convened a Northeast Political Affairs Committee conference at Mukden, which was attended by senior Chinese members of the new regime, including Zhang Xinhui, Ma Jieshan, Zhang Xiyi, Xi Qia, and others. The purpose of the conference was to appoint the delegates to positions in the soon-to-be-announced Manchukuo. Ma Jieshan was given $1 million worth of gold and appointed governor of Heliaozhang province on February the 14th. On the 27th, Ding Chao offered to cease hostilities, officially ending the Chinese resistance in Manchuria. On March the 1st, Puyi was placed on the throne of the new puppet state of Manchukuo. While Japan consolidated its control over Manchuria, conflict would also break out in Shanghai. Prior to the Mukden incident, Shanghai had been a place of conflict between the two nations. On July the 1st of 1931, Korean subjects of the Japanese Empire had subleased land from a local Chinese broker in the small village of Wanpaoshan. Foreign to Chinese farmers affected by the land seizure attacked the Koreans, prompting both Chinese and Japanese police to break up the situation. Anti-Chinese riots broke out in multiple cities in Korea, seeing hundreds of Chinese killed. This led to the formation of an anti-Japanese committee, who called for the boycott of Japanese goods. The movement grew exponentially after the Mukden incident broke out on September the 18th. The anti-Japanese committee renamed itself the Shanghai Committee to resist Japan and save the nation. On October the 19th, the Chamber of Commerce organized an economic boycott of Japan. Their headquarters were located at Tianhokang, within the international settlement. They began raising anti-Japanese rallies, put up posters, staged anti-Japanese movies and theater shows. The economic impact was tremendous. Over 29% of Shanghai's imports came from Japan in 1930. By December of 1931, this fell to just 3%. Japanese shipping along the Chinese coast and the Yangtze River was hit quite hard. The Nishin Steam Company was forced to suspend operations. Around 125 Japanese-operated factories in Shanghai had to stop production. By November, 80% were shut down. Damages were estimated to be at around 41 million yen between July 1931 to March of 1932. Behind all of these efforts, anti-Japanese volunteer corps were organized and trained by the Kuomintang. By November the 17th, more than 17,000 had applied, and on December the 1st, 3 volunteer corps camps were established. The Japanese government responded by sending a warning to China. On October the 10th, the Nanjing government was reminded they held the sole responsibility for controlling the anti-Japanese boycott and protection for the lives and property of Japanese residents. Nanjing responded they could not be expected to suppress the people's right to choose commodities. Conflict soon emerged, and on January the 8th, 5 Japanese Nichiren Buddhist monks were attacked by a Chinese mob. The monks had been shouting anti-Chinese slogans, and they were beaten up near the Shanghai Sanyo factory. 2 of them were severely injured and 1 died. In retaliation, some Japanese youth set fire to the Sanyo factory, and by 2:30 they were attacked by Chinese police, causing casualties on both sides. The consul general, Murai Kurematsu, issued a condemnation of the killing of the Japanese monks. The Chinese issued an apology and promised they would pay reparations and find the culprits responsible. But the Japanese residents were not satisfied with this. On January the 20th, there was a call for Japan to send forces to quell the anti-Japanese movement in Shanghai. A mob of more than 1,000 rushed to the IGN headquarters and demanded Captain Samajima Tomoshige take action. The cruiser Oi and the 15th Destroyer Squadron, led by Shibazawa Koichi, came on January the 23rd. The next day, the aircraft carrier, Notoro, the 1st Torpedo Squadron, and the 2nd Special Marine Regiment, around 1,833 men strong, joined them at the Shanghai shoreline. Meanwhile, the Chinese 19th Route Army of General Tai Tingkai had been massing outside the city of Shanghai. They were roughly 33,500 men strong, composed mostly of men from Guangdong and Guangxi.
They had been engaged in anti-communist campaigns in Jiangxi, but by December they had been ordered to replace General Song Shihui's army, who were stationed at the Nanjing-Shanghai Railway. Given the 19th Red Army's strong anti-Japanese attitudes, coupled with the Mukden incident and other recent events, a clash between them near Shanghai seemed imminent. Rear Admiral Shiwazawa notified the British at Shanghai that Japanese Marines would be starting an action on January the 29th. The Municipal Council of Shanghai issued martial law, and the British, French, and Italian forces and volunteer corps mobilized into defensive positions. At 8:30 p.m., Shiwazawa made two declarations, one calling upon the Chinese army to evacuate from the Chaipei area, and the second prohibiting public meetings that might interfere with military actions. At 9 p.m., 478 Marines landed to join up with the 1,365 Marines already ashore. By 11:30 p.m., the Marines were moving into assigned positions. The 19th Route Army did not evacuate. At around midnight on the 28th, the Japanese Marines suddenly attacked the western side of the North Sichuan Road. From there, the fighting spread to the whole of Chaipei. The Chinese focused much of their attacks against the Hongku District, within the Japanese defensive sector. Over 3,000 Japanese sailors were mobilized in response to the escalating battle. On the 29th, Notaro launched an airstrike against positions held by the 19th Route Army. In response, the Chinese Air Force launched 9 aircraft to the Hangqiao Aerodrome, leading to the first aerial battle, though they did not suffer many losses. Japan began sending reinforcements in the form of a new squadron organized under the command of Vice Admiral Nomura Kichisaburo. By February the 1st, a full-scale attack was made against Chaipei. 2 days later, it was extended against the Wusang and Kaohsiung fortresses. By the 30th of January, Chiang Kai-shek decided to temporarily move the capital from Nanjing to Luoyang. At this point, the battle extended to Hongku, Chaipei, Wusan, and Qiangwan. The Japanese Marines now realized they were in trouble and they would do the unthinkable. On January the 31st, the IGN swallowed its pride and the Navy Minister, Osumi Minoy, requested support from the IJA. The IJA were engrossed in the operation against Harbin, but offered to send the 9th Division stationed at Kanazawa. On February the 2nd, the IJA and IGN convened for a joint strategic planning session. The 9th Division and the 24th Mixed Brigade departed Virginia on February the 9th, and they landed at Shanghai by the 16th. The Japanese now had roughly 18,000 forces. In response, Chiang Kai-shek sent the 5th Army and the 87th and 88th Divisions. Lieutenant General Ueda Kinkichi led the Expeditionary Army with orders to first try and get the Chinese troops to evacuate peacefully. If the Chinese continued to fight, the 9th would drive them west of the Kunshan-Qingpu-Shengqiang line. On the 18th, the Japanese sent Major General Tashiro Kanichiro to meet with the representatives of the 19th Army in the French settlement, presided over by the British Minister Sir Miles Lampson. They spoke for 2 hours, and the Chinese refused to yield. The Japanese presented an ultimatum. At 9 p.m., the Chinese army was ordered to withdraw 20 kilometers beyond the settlement limits by 5 p.m. on February the 20th. Failing to do so, the Japanese would take any action they deemed necessary. The Chinese did not yield. At 9:30 a.m. on the 20th, Ueda ordered a concentrated attack upon the Qianwanchen area. Artillery, naval, and aerial bombardments battered the Chinese defenders near Miaohang. The Chinese positions were being destroyed rapidly as they were significantly outgunned. Yet after 2 days of fierce battle, the Japanese were not making any progress against Qianwanchen. By the 22nd, they shifted their focus north of Qianwanchen, and they were equally unsuccessful. On the 23rd, the Chinese performed an offensive against the northern wing of the Japanese forces, but they were repelled. By the 28th, after a week of fierce fighting, the Japanese managed to seize the village of Qiangwan. Army Minister Araki then sent the 11th and 14th Divisions of General Shirakawa Yoshinori to take command of the Expeditionary Army. The reinforcements landed on March the 1st at the Wusang Railway Pier behind the Chinese lines and immediately joined the battle. The Chinese launched a counterattack, but they were unable to dislodge the new forces. By this time, Japanese intelligence indicated the Chinese army was secretly preparing a general withdrawal. Emboldened by the news, the Expeditionary Army sought to deliver a decisive blow. Fearing encirclement, the Chinese army began a general withdrawal on March the 2nd. The 9th and 11th Divisions attempted an encirclement attack, but the Chinese were able to escape. The League of Nations had scheduled a meeting on March the 3rd to try and force a truce, so the Japanese halted their pursuit of the enemy by 2 p.m. The truce negotiations had begun as soon as the fighting had broken out in late January. It was brought about largely because foreign governments were concerned with the safety of the international settlement. Multiple meetings were held, but each saw refusals. The Japanese sought to defeat the 19th Route Army before any truce was signed. Once the Chinese were expelled 20 kilometers beyond the settlement, Shirakawa called for a unilateral truce, intent on acting the victor of the forthcoming peace conference. Both China and Japan accepted the League of Nations resolution on March the 4th, calling for an opening of truce negotiations presided over by a committee made up of British, American, French, Italian, Japanese, and Chinese representatives. Shanghai was made a demilitarized zone. China was forbidden from garrisoning troops in the surrounding Shanghai area, Suzhou and Kunshan. Japan was allowed a limited amount of troops within the city, and China was allowed a small police force in the city. The January 28th incident, or Shanghai incident, coincided with the fight for Harbin, and both affected another. The year of 1932 ushered in a new state called Manchukuo, in many ways the product of one man, Kanji Ishiwara. However, Ishiwara did not foresee what would result from all of this, for the 15-year war had just unofficially begun. Japan was ushering in her own doom.